Hi, Jason.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, thanks.
Good. I should tell people that you are Jason Stearns, and you're in Congo. This is an episode of Worldwise, which often features people in other countries, but you're in a particularly exotic country, and one that right now is active in a not necessarily good way. There's been a rebellion there that we want to talk about that I guess has some prospect of turning into a wider war, possibly between Congo and Rwanda. But before we get into that, let me introduce you a little. You're the author of a history of the Congo War of from 1998 to 2003, which, although it was kind of epically destructive and lethal, I think most Americans know very little about. Your book is called Dancing in the Glory of Monsters. You also blog at your blog, which is called Congo Siasa. And Siasa, you just explained to me, means, I think, politics in Swahili. And you're director of the Rift Valley Institute's Usalama Project, I believe. Now, was any of that inaccurate?
No, that's absolutely correct.
Okay, good. So I'm on a roll. Okay, so, you know, what's been a little bit in the headlines in America is that there's this rebel movement called M23 in Congo, which briefly a couple of weeks ago seized the city of Goma and then withdrew from the city of Goma a few days ago. And things are kind of uncertain now. The rebel movement is generally associated with Rwanda. Some people claim it's essentially a proxy for Rwanda. And we want to get into the background of all this and what exactly M23 is. But first, let me ask you kind of a macroscopic question that may be helpful. I mean, if this did turn into a big war between Congo and Rwanda, what are the kind of fault lines that would have kind of led to that? You know, I mean, are we talking about fundamentally their important ethnic fault lines? I mean, the rebels are thought of as mainly Tutsis, I think, which is, of course, one of the two ethnic groups that was involved in the Rwandan genocide. It was the victims, by and large, of the genocide. You know, are we talking about ethnic, linguistic, religious fault lines, or a sheerly national thing between Congo or Rwanda, or is it just way too complicated for any of those characterizations? How would you describe it?
Well, I think it's not too complicated at all for characterizations. I just would resist to have those sort of identity characterizations dominate our analysis. I think that ethnicities in these countries are extremely important. Politics is often built around ethnicity, but ethnicities themselves are constructed, and ethnicity can sometimes be covers or shields of interest politics. So I think that in order to understand what's really behind this, it's more helpful to go a little bit into the history of things rather than to bandy about ethnicities as somehow explanatory causes of what's really going on here. It is true that, for example, there is the government in Rwanda is you could say has a very strong representation of the Tutsi community, and that many of the rebels are Tutsi as well. At least the M23 rebels come from the Tutsi community as well. But I think that not only is that reductive and not very helpful, it also could reinforce some of the stereotypes in the region. There are many people in the region that tend to blame entire communities for abuses or the faults of individuals. So I think we need to resist that.
Okay. So how would you, so when people say to you, what is this conflict fundamentally about? And it's somebody who, like me, doesn't know very much, genuinely needs to be enlightened. What's your short answer?
There are, before I get into the history of things, I think the history does do a lot of the explaining itself, but from more of a structural point of view, you can break it down to three primary causes. The first one is the dereliction of the Congolese state. You could say the Congolese state has been hollowed out from the within. State institutions are incredibly weak. That was, I think, very visible in the last couple of weeks when the Congolese army took a thrashing by these rebel forces. They were on the run. They themselves are very notorious for committing a lot of abuses. And that weakness of the Congolese state goes back probably to the colonial period under Belgian colonization, but certainly also to the dictatorships that followed that. That there's a tendency, I think, by Congolese leaders, instead of building strong institutions, to rather actually undermine state institutions, fearing that strong institutions could be a threat to them. They'd prefer to have the state being weak so they can manipulate key players and key institutions within the state. So you've had a history of disorder actually being used as a strategy of rule here, and leaders undermining their own institutions, which has created a security vacuum, you could say, in which groups like this M23 rebellion, but dozens of other armed groups that exist here in the Eastern Congo thrive. So I think that is sort of the first cause, I would say, of this conflict. The second thing I would point to, which has been in the media a lot, as you pointed out, is involvement by Rwanda. Now, in order to understand involvement by Rwanda, you have to go back at least to 1994 when the genocide took place, as you mentioned, and the perpetrators of the genocide, along with roughly a million other people, fled into the Eastern Congo after the current Rwandan government came to power. And then the current Rwandan government continued to fight.
Excuse me, these were largely ethnic Hutus who fled into Congo?
That's correct. It was almost exclusively people from the Hutu ethnic group. And the Rwandan government, the current Rwandan government that came to power, then continued to wage a war against its enemies, but on Congolese soil. And that some
right,
of the following
if
wars...
If I can just interject, can I just ask one more question? So, kind of like ironically or whatever, the victims of the Rwandan genocide, their ethnic group wound up being empowered in the aftermath of the genocide. Is that right? So that you had Tutsis who had been the victims of the persecution, they nonetheless were, at the risk of oversimplifying, in a position of power, and their persecutors and people associated with the persecutors then fled into Congo, and they were largely Hutus.
Yes, at the risk of being reductive, I would say that's correct, although again, with all the caveats of the fact that ethnicity is often used as a pretext and an excuse and masks underlying power and interests, I would say that that's roughly correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sorry, go ahead.
So anyway, so what I was saying is that to understand the role of the Rwandan government in the current crisis, you have to go back to that period, 1994. The genocide took place, the perpetrators fled into the Eastern Congo, and then the Rwandan government continued waging war against them, but on Congolese soil. And that explains much of the, or at least some of the subsequent history and some of the subsequent wars in the Congo, in which the Rwandan government has always played a very important role. And therefore, Rwanda has come to see the Eastern Congo as essential for its strategic interests. And essential initially because of security. As I said, its enemies all fled there and continued to wage a war against Rwanda based out of the Eastern Congo. So initially the impetus was very much one of security. But, you know, subsequently as Rwanda became more and more involved in fighting in the Congo, it armed proxy groups, it had allies here in the Congo. It also had developed economic and political interests in the Eastern Congo as well. And so it's sort of this combination
of
the...
Which is very mineral... Eastern Congo is very mineral rich, I'm told, and that is one of the issues. It's a prize.
It is, although I think sometimes people overemphasize minerals are one of the many riches here in the Eastern Congo, but armed groups and rebel groups make money. Basically what they do is they tax anything that they can tax. So it's not about minerals or other things. It's about how much these things are worth. So there are people who've made a fortune off the charcoal trade, for example, or the palm oil trade, or simply doing business of cross-border trade and fuel and electronics and other things. So anybody who controls trade in the region, be it mineral or otherwise, stands to make a fortune. And the Rwandan government in different points in time has made a lot of money off different kinds of trade, as have many other people.
Okay.
So what I was going to say is the second factor is this Rwandan involvement in the Eastern Congo with so this regional dynamic. And we can get back to talking a little bit about that in terms of the M23 crisis. But this is sort of the regional dimension where I had there's a national dimension, which is the collapse of the Congolese state. There's a regional dimension where Rwanda has become, and other countries as well, but in particular Rwanda has become extremely involved in the Eastern Congo for these variety of reasons. And then the third dynamic is a very localized dynamic in which local power players, local elites, local businessmen, local customary chiefs fight over extremely local issues, land, customary authority or political power, control of a particular mining concession or of a particular trade route. And it's these local issues often that do a lot of the explaining when it comes to the particular reasons for violence. So it's a combination. The Congolese conflict is really this sort of these set of babushka dolls, if you will, where you have local issues nested within national issues, nested within regional issues, and these things are all intertwined in this very sort of potent, toxic brew.
Okay. So there's, first of all, a power vacuum in certain parts of the Congo. There are local groups that, for their own reasons, try to fill the power vacuum. And then there is, beyond that, Rwanda, which has a history of antagonism with Congo, which has what it sees as its own interests in the region, and to some extent makes use of some local Congolese factions that are themselves, you know, interested in filling the power vacuum. And I guess one of those is M23 movement, which has been in the headlines lately, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And just on that note, what I would say is that, you know, you spoke about the ethnic Tutsi community as playing a key role. They are, I could say, one of the, you know, the key constituencies in this. I mean, the military leadership of the M23 is predominantly Tutsi. And to understand their role in this rebellion and why the Congolese Tutsi community, actually in every single rebellion that's been backed by Rwanda, has played such a key role, you really need to go back into history, to colonial times. And without digressing too much, I think it's very key for people to understand this colonial history. The Belgian colonial government between 1930 and 1960 basically transplanted upwards of 300,000 people from Rwanda into the highlands of the Eastern Congo. The reason they did that was because local Belgian colonizers, they were in need of manual labor and very pliable labor, in other words, labor that they could easily control. And in Rwanda, there was a population surplus. So they basically did some demographic engineering of the region that I think has been now, the consequences have been pretty disastrous. Transplanting 300,000 Hutu and Tutsi, predominantly Hutu, but many Tutsi as well, from Rwanda into the Eastern Congo. And those groups then have had their citizenship contested in the post-colonial period. So the Congolese government in the post-colonial period has often said, well, you guys aren't Congolese, you don't have right to be here. And those groups feel discriminated against, and they feel very nervous about their own identity and citizenship and place in Congolese society. But at the same time, parts of those groups, and particularly within the Tutsi community, have benefited from largesse from the state. In other words, they've benefited from, being close to the government, having preferential treatment, having access to state contracts and state land. So you have this mixture of discrimination, but also preferential treatment against members in this community that makes them feel discriminated against. And if you speak to people in the M23, people in the Congolese Tutsi community today, this history of discrimination is one of the first things that they will mention. But other Congolese communities that they're being hypocritical in the sense that they have themselves benefited from preferential treatment, and they themselves have been consistently prominent in various different rebel groups that are often extremely abusive.
Right, and as I understand it, this relates to kind of the recent history of the M23 movement. So as I understand it, this is thought of by many as kind of the recurrence of a rebellion by this group, and it gets the name M23, I gather, from an agreement on March 23rd in, I don't know, 2009, 2010 or something, where when the previous, if I'm correct, the previous rebellion by what is to some extent the same group ended when the group was given guarantees about having a certain amount of security and power and a certain kind of role in government and a certain role in the Congolese army. Is that right? And then this kind of came apart, or at least the group is now arguing that guarantees that were made to it by the government at that time about its security and its power were not kept. Is this more or less right?
I think that's very accurate. Let me just take a little step back from what you just said to go back to the Congolese War as a general, because I think it helps explain what's going on today. The Congo was in a state of civil and regional war between 1996, roughly speaking, and 2003. This war involved 9 different African countries and split the country effectively into 3 different parts, or actually 5 or 6 different parts, depending on how you count. That state of affairs ended in 2003 with a peace deal that brought the whole country together, and and created a transitional government, and eventually brought about the first democratic elections in 30 years in the Congo. But the problem with that peace deal, and I think this is one of the reasons that you've had these rebellions in the Eastern Congo, is it was extremely disadvantageous to probably one of the strongest belligerent factions. There was a Rwandan-backed rebel group here in the Eastern Congo that controlled roughly a third of the Congo during the war that was extremely unpopular and stood to lose most of its power during elections. So because this whole peace deal was based on going to elections, this armed group in the Eastern Congo didn't really see it that it was in their interest to go to elections, and they then basically they had a plan B to going to elections, which is starting another rebellion. And so they started another rebellion, roughly speaking, in 2004, 2005. That was called the CNDP, to get you lost a little bit in the alphabet soup of armed groups in the Eastern Congo. And the CNDP then was the armed group, backed by Rwanda again, that was integrated into the Congolese army in 2009. And that peace deal happened on March 23rd, 2009. Mm-hmm. And it's that peace deal that the current mutineers, this current rebellion, refer to. And the current mutineers who launched this rebellion in April this year, they point back to that rebellion, CNDP armed group, that deal that happened in 2009, and said the Congolese government didn't live up to their promises, they didn't live up to this agreement, and this is why they launched another rebellion now in April this year. So you really, what you see is recurrent rebellions in the Eastern Congo consistently coming out of at least roughly similar communities and consistently backed by the Rwandan government and going back to a failure in the peace deal to deal with some of these underlying issues here in the Eastern Congo.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, why did this M23 group withdraw from the city of Goma so shortly, you know, just a few days ago, so shortly after taking control of it, in your view?
Well, so this rebellion was launched earlier this year in April. It not only was, you know, received a lot of international condemnation for undermining the stability in the region. We, roughly speaking, have had around 700,000 displaced people on the run in the Eastern Congo since early this year. But there was also a lot of evidence of Rwandan backing to this armed group, and the Rwandan government came under a lot of pressure. Over 12% of its budget has been cut by foreign donors, and that has hit them, I think, fairly hard. So we don't know exactly why they withdrew. They say they withdrew because they wanted to give peace a chance. But I think probably the more likely reason is because they were being pummeled in the PR battle, and they wanted to be able to get I think the moral upper hand, if you will. They wanted to seem like they were part of the solution, not part of the problem. They wanted to get some good press. It wouldn't surprise me as well if Rwanda wanted to get some weight off its back. There was a regional grouping of regional countries as well, that including Rwanda and the Congo, that recommended the withdrawal of the M23 from Goma. So I think, you know, in this battle, the rebels often are extremely sensitive to international pressure. It's strange, I think, for American listeners to hear that, given the fact they don't know very much about this conflict. But every single rebel group here in the Eastern Congo feels that this mythical beast of the international community is the main power broker, the main audience to all everything that goes on here in the Eastern Congo. So when it speaks, people listen.
That's really interesting. I mean, why is that? I would think that if the so-called international community, you know, didn't have actual leverage, you know, if there was nothing that the rebels, you know, feared in concrete terms from the international community, or no benefit, no concrete benefits that were flowing to it from the international community, I would think that they wouldn't have reason to care. So are there sticks and carrots that are being brought to bear by the international community, or what? Why do the rebels care what the world thinks of them?
Well, that's a very good question. I think a lot of diplomats, you know, I can't tell you how many diplomats I meet who wring their hands and say, oh, we don't have any leverage. I think the facts are a little bit different. Every single government in this region receives over 40% of its budget through international aid. At least the Rwandan government does. The Congolese government certainly does. So just in terms of finances in the region, this international community, and when they say international community, they largely mean Western countries, but also the World Bank, the IMF, have a lot of financial leverage. The other thing you have to realize is that, you know, the country, the Congo, the region, Rwanda as well, they've been through decades now of war. And in at least in the Congo, every single one of these wars has ended in negotiation. And these negotiations are usually under the auspices of this international community. So you don't want to offend these people too much, because at the end of the day, they're going to be the ones coming in, brokering peace, doing negotiations. And if you offend them too much, then it's going to be difficult. You know, you've had the Congo, again, not terribly well known to people, but the Congo has produced the whole first load of people to go to the International Criminal Court in The Hague have come from the Congo. The first indictee, the first person to be sentenced by the International Criminal Court, the first, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the first four people in the docket of the International Criminal Court were all from the Congo, to the extent that the Congolese used to joke that it's the ICC stands for the International Court for the Congo. So, you know, the international community has enormous influence in this country, but you wouldn't sometimes know it listening to diplomats.
Now, that's interesting because, you know, the in America, I think it's still the case that these, you know, high-minded sounding international institutions are thought of as well-meaning but impotent. But are you saying that actually in Africa, a dictator or anybody else might actually think twice about committing atrocities because the International Criminal Court is thought of as having real power?
Well, there's competing imperatives, if you will, for a dictator or a rebel leader, even a democratically elected president, in the sense that they have to survive. Often surviving, they understand surviving to mean being able to extract a large amount of resources, often illegally, because that's the only way they can extract a large amount of resources to buy people off. It often means intimidating people, and intimidating people means that you have to often, again, break the law. So, you know, there are unfortunately incentives in the country like the Congo or Rwanda for leaders to break the law, and sometimes to break it very viciously. At the same time, more and more, there is also this idea that, you know, breaking the law in too egregious a fashion can come back to haunt you. I wouldn't say that the International Criminal Court has completely, you know, changed people's frame of reference here. I mean, people still do carry out atrocities. The vast majority of these atrocities go unpunished. So impunity is still the name of the game here, if you will. But it has changed things a little bit, and I think that people understand this. If it hadn't been for the indictment of, for example, one of the main leaders in this current conflict in the M23, Bosco Ntaganda, who's wanted by the International Criminal Court but still running around in the Eastern Congo, I think that the behavior would have been slightly different.
Okay. So what do you expect to happen now with M23? I mean, first of all, how worried should we be that this could turn into a very large war between Congo and Rwanda? Is there a significant chance that this thing could get really out of hand?
Well, I think there's room for pessimism. There's always room for pessimism in the Congo, unfortunately. The main room for skepticism and pessimism is that the rebels and the Rwandan government have very little trust and confidence in the Congolese government. They look at Joseph Kabila, President Joseph Kabila, and they see someone who has not lived up to his word, someone who is interested in personal enrichment, but who has done very little for in terms of creating national institutions, and someone who can't guarantee their interests, whatever those interests may be, security, economic, the ones I mentioned before. And they also see someone who's not a valid sort of interlocutor for these peace talks. So they're going to go into these peace talks. The Congolese government, at least when I speak to them, they say that they envisage largely another sharing of the pie solution. In other words, we're going to give them some positions here and there, maybe a national ministry, some command positions in the army, and we're going to buy them off like that. And the problem for that, for the rebels with that, is that they don't trust the Congolese government to live up to those commitments. Who's to say that the moment the Congolese government strikes a deal like that and they integrate these people into the army, they don't turn around and arrest them all? So the mistrust at the moment, I think, has gotten to very risky levels, to levels that mean that both Rwanda and the M23 may prefer escalation instead of compromise. So I think peace talks are currently ongoing now, but my feeling is this is a tactical retreat and a tactical ceasefire that is most likely to end in a further escalation of violence. If there is not, and here again I think the international community can play an important role, if there is not much more significant deployment of diplomatic and political capital in the region, and by that I mean a special envoy from the United Nations, high-level attention from people like the U.S. Secretary of State, and others, increased financial pressures on both governments to play a constructive role in ending this crisis, considering sending a military mission here to the Eastern Congo with a much more proactive and strong mandate to deal, to actually protect civilians and preempt further violence. So I think that those things could get us closer to a stable solution, but without those things, my guess is that we're looking at another escalation of violence here.
Okay, you mentioned a military mission. I mean, under whose auspices would that come? Would that be technically a regional force, or and would it have a UN mandate? And does such a force already exist in some measure?
So the force that's been here since 2000s is the UN peacekeeping force. There are 19,000 UN peacekeepers here. It's one of the largest UN peacekeeping forces in the world. It costs a lot of money. It costs $1.4 billion a year. Largely footed by the United States, the U.S. government pays roughly 25 to 30% of that. So there is already a peacekeeping force here. The problem with that peacekeeping force in many people's eyes is that its mandate is not aggressive enough. In other words, they are more observers than players in the conflict. For example, with the fall of Goma recently, they didn't stand by and let Goma fall, but at the end of the day, when the Congolese army crumbled and ran, they also didn't stand up to protect the town, and many people were outraged by that. So the regional countries, so the countries in the immediate region here in Central Africa, have proposed, you could say, a competitor force or an alternative force to the UN force. They call it a neutral force. This neutral force was initially supposed to consist of 4,000 soldiers from the region to go in and, as they said, quote-unquote, eradicate rebel forces, which meant basically waging war against the M23, as well as Rwandan rebels that the Rwandan government is seen to be concerned about here in the Eastern Congo. The problem with that force, I think in particular, is that nobody really thinks that countries in the region are willing to send 4,000 soldiers into what would be extremely dangerous and risky counterinsurgency operations. I mean, these people will be going into very difficult terrain, deep jungles, mountainous areas, and fighting against relatively well-organized armed groups. This means casualties. This is kind of stuff that the U.S. has been engaged in elsewhere with far more equipment and better training. And I think that countries in the region would probably be pretty reluctant to do that. It would also be expensive. They've said that it would be probably roughly $100 million a year, although, as I said before, the UN peacekeeping mission is far more expensive than that. So, you know, there are various different military options that can be put on the table, but I would emphasize that I don't think anybody can shoot their way out of this problem. I think there has to be a political solution or a political process. And in the framework of that political process, you can see how military force could help put pressure on various sides. But I don't think military force in the absence of a larger political process is going to be successful.
So it sounds like you think, to some extent, it's really a question of focus. The American administration, for one thing, just paying more attention and devoting more diplomatic resources and things like that. Am I wrong?
I think so. You know, one of the things you can go back and look at, there was a peace deal, as I said before, that reunited the country between 2003 and 2006 and brought it to democratic elections that were relatively good elections. And I think that is a period that can inspire people for various reasons. You have the international community reading from the same sheet of paper, in the sense that the U.S., the Brits, the French, the South Africans, the Angolans, to a certain extent even the Chinese, the Russians, were all focused on the same thing. There was a U.N., there was a treaty that was brokered by, a peace deal brokered by the United Nations, and everybody was part of this political process, getting together to the same goal, reuniting the country and having elections. And since then, since the end of the peace process in 2006, there has been this illusion or this fantasy that the war is over and that we've entered into this post-conflict phase, except for the fact that the war isn't over and violence has actually escalated in the Eastern Congo. But there's no more peace process and the donors are no longer reading from the same sheet of paper. Everybody's, you know, looking after their own interests. There's mines here, people looking after the mines. People have business interests and geopolitical interests that are different. So there has been not only an absence of a political process to deal with the violence, but there's been a fragmentation of this international community. And I think this is one of the reasons that we haven't been able to reach an end to this violence. I mean, no matter what, some of the problems here are extremely intractable and will be extremely difficult to deal with. But there hasn't really been the political will, as you pointed out, sort of the political capital expended to deal with these issues, and instead we've been spending an enormous amount of money. I mean, money is not the problem here. People spend a lot of money on the Congo, but you don't have a commensurate amount of political will and a political process to go with it.
Okay. Now, speaking of that, and speaking of American involvement in the region, you've written a little about the Susan Rice issue, because although, of course, what's dominated the headlines in the controversy over her possible appointment to be Secretary of State is the Benghazi episode. She had this history in Africa during the Clinton administration that is controversial and that some people think should be taken into account in deciding whether or not she should be Secretary of State. Do you want to just give us quickly kind of the background on that and what your assessment of it is?
Sure, yeah. Susan Rice was a member of the Clinton administration from 1993 to 2001. She worked on Africa policy for that whole time. She was a member of the National Security Council, rose to be the head of Africa on the National Security Council, and then was Assistant Secretary of State for Africa until the end of the Clinton administration. During that time, you had the genocide in Rwanda, you had mass violence in Burundi, and you had the two Congo wars here, or at least the height of the Congo war took place. Now, obviously, she wasn't to blame for all of that, but those events really marked, I think, her tenure there in the Clinton administration. The first incident, obviously, that marked her tenure was the Rwandan genocide, and she felt personally, I think, very guilty for U.S. inaction during the genocide, and both she as well as President Clinton have said that they have one of the biggest regrets of their lives will be international inaction in the face of mass violence and genocide in Rwanda. And she vowed for that never to happen again. But immediately in the wake of the genocide, the Clinton administration became involved in the championing, you could say, of new African leaders. They saw a new breed of African leaders arising on the continent, very often coming to power through rebellions, and having a much more energetic, visionary approach to leadership that were open to human rights and to free markets, to open to economic reforms, that were speaking the language really that I think many people in the West wanted to hear, and that also seemed to be much more responsible than the older breed, the typical sort of stereotypical African dinosaur dictators. So Susan Rice was involved in this championing of new leaders in Eritrea, Ethiopia, South Sudan, Uganda, and in Rwanda. And in particular, the Clinton administration backed what they saw was a visionary government in Rwanda. This was led by the current president, Paul Kagame, that was able to do an enormous amount. They were able to rebuild their country after the genocide, to rise it up out of the ashes, to rebuild infrastructure, institutions, to tackle everything from grassroots reconciliation and justice to healthcare reforms that would make the United States look jealous. So there's no doubt that the Rwandan government came very far, and I think that this is one of the reasons that Susan Rice and many other people in the Clinton administration, she wasn't alone, felt that they should give them the benefit of the doubt when it came to the Congo. Now, things have changed drastically over the last decade in the Congo, and it should be said that when Rwanda first invaded the Congo in 1996, that it did so with extremely good security justification. In other words, the people who had just committed the genocide had fled here to the eastern Congo, and they were launching attacks into Rwanda. Up until 1999, the whole area of northwestern Rwanda was in a state of insurgency and mass violence. So Rwanda had a very good justification up until that time for maintaining a security presence in the eastern Congo. But progressively, that justification has waned, and even during that period, the Rwandan government used that justification, I think you could say, as a blank check for not only carrying out some extremely gruesome human rights abuses here in the eastern Congo, but also profiting financially from the eastern Congo. So I think the main criticism that people like Susan Rice was not that they were sympathetic towards the Rwandan government, not that they saw visionary leaders there, but that there was no nuance to their policy, that they couldn't see that and the abuses going on there as well, that they couldn't see the positives and the negatives together. And I think that is probably the biggest gripe that I would have with the Clinton administration policy in the region and with Susan Rice in particular. Now,
okay, so we got cut off there, but my question was this performance you described, a policy lacking nuance, is that really like below average for U.S. policy in Africa, or could you, so is Susan Rice in that sense subpar, or could you say that that's kind of par for the course?
I'm an expert on Central Africa. I would say that, and I would not want to generalize across Africa to say what U.S. policy is or is not. I think in general, it is a lot to ask of U.S. diplomats to expend what I would call political capital as well as financial capital in many of these areas. Rwanda, Congo, they figure far down in terms of U.S. priorities worldwide. And it's difficult to capture the attention of Secretary of State, of Congress, of the President himself in these various crises. But I would say that, I think it is a lot to ask, but this is one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes of our time. One of the problems the Congo has is a PR problem. It's not only one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes of our time, it's also one of the hardest to explain and to spin. So the reasons that journalists and politicians don't focus a lot of time on the Congo, despite the immense bloodshed and suffering here, is not just because they don't care about black people and don't care about Africans, but it's extremely difficult to understand and to grasp, as your listeners are probably beginning to see. And this has been the curse of the Congo. The curse of the Congo has been its complexity, has been the difficulty to understand something that is not easily boiled down to good and evil, to black and white, and to understand these vast sort of networks of criminality and crime that have produced the conflict. So it's much easier just to say, well, there's a good guy, there's a bad guy. The government in Rwanda has done some bad things, but by and large, our policy should be to strengthen it. It's, of course, easier to do that. But I do think, given the enormous suffering and bloodshed here, that it deserves more, and more political capital should be expended, and it's not a good enough excuse just to say we don't know what's going on or we're not sure. We need to spend as much political capital as we spend financial capital on this region.
Okay. let me ask you one more question before we go. I always try to get a sense when I talk to people in another country of kind of how America is perceived there, what America means there. When you're out on the streets in the part of Congo you're in, And I take it you're from the United States. I haven't actually asked, but judging by your accent, that sounds about right. How do you find people reacting to the idea of America? What does America mean to people in the Congo?
Well, you know, I think many Americans would be surprised. The Congolese feel that America is this hulking figure in their lives, that America has enormous influence, whereas most Americans probably couldn't find the Congo on a map. Congolese feel, you know, they're convinced that, you know, President Obama wakes up every morning to his Congo briefing and that he follows Congo issues extremely closely. And unfortunately, the truth is probably quite a ways away from that. The people here are, you will find people, you'll go to very remote areas of the Congo. When I tell them that I'm from the United States, they will say how angry they are at Bill Clinton and at Bill Clinton's administration. They will know details about Clinton administration. They'll probably know very skewed and biased and maybe not accurate details, but they will know about Bill Clinton. I talk to Congolese local politicians here who know Susan Rice, who know other American figures, and who feel very resentful about U.S. policy, in particular during that time. I think they also feel that American foreign policy has changed over the last 10 years, as it has. But that resentment, I think, is still the preponderant feeling that they have towards America. And I remember that and I described this in my book, but I was on the lake here. You can't see it here, but to my right, there's a very large lake, a very beautiful lake. And I was on the lake traveling from the south end of the lake to the north end of the lake. And I had 6 hours to spend with some local traders. And they describe it as the system that they're caught in is the Babylon system. They feel like they're in Babylon. This was sort of Bob Marley reference, if I remember correctly, that they're in Babylon and that Babylon is basically being perpetrated by the United States. In other words, the United States is the puppeteer pulling the strings here, and the poor Congolese are the ones who suffer. Now, obviously, not all Congolese feel the same way, but there is a feeling that, as they will often put it, okay, so the United States isn't to blame here, but they are the biggest superpower in the world, and if they wanted to stop it, they could, so they're guilty complicity out of negligence. I think you could probably describe it. I think that's many Congolese would feel that.
Okay. But they think, I take it, they think that President Obama, some of them, is paying more attention to the region, and they think that just because he is himself of African descent?
I'm not entirely sure that they think that he's paying more attention to the region. I think that they feel, and here it depends very much on which kind of Congolese, on who you talk to, whether it's elites or whether it's people in the village. But I think they feel that American policy in general has shifted. This current M23 crisis has really crystallized that. You know, you had a debate on the floor of the Senate today that was very critical, extremely critical of Rwanda and Rwandan support to the M23. Many Congolese feel that kind of debate could not have taken place 10 years ago, and it probably didn't take place in the same sort of setting and the same sort of rhetoric with the same rhetoric 10 years ago. So I think that many Congolese feel that it's shifting. I don't necessarily think they feel that it's because Obama is of African heritage, but I think it's just because they realize that the times are changing and that Rwanda has fallen out of favor to a certain extent with some parts of the American political spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, listen, Jason, thank you so much for taking the time, and thanks for, you know, just staying there and grappling with all this, because it sounds like it can get a little depressing at times, and I admire you for doing it. Your book, again, is Dancing in the Glory of Monsters, about a really huge and horrific war that ended about 10 years ago there that Americans don't know enough about. Your blog is Congo Siasa, and I believe your Twitter handle is at Jason K. Stearns, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. Well, listen, thanks again. I hope we'll do this again at some point, and keep up the good work.
It was my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Bye-bye.